When you get a phone call from a number you don't recognize and wait through a pregnant pause on the other end, you're probably getting a robocall. Most of us just hang up in disgust, but the irritation remains, along with the feeling that someone must be making money from all this. They are, and the expansion of robocalls is a thorn in the side of consumer protection agencies. We asked Stephen Levins, Executive Director of the State of Hawaii's Office of Consumer Protection, if he'd seen an increase lately in the number of calls being made.
I've seen statistics where there are over a billion a month of these robocalls that are being made to people everywhere in the country.
It must work at some point, but, you know, most of the time we get a robocall, you realize it's a robocall, you hang up, and you think, boy, they just wasted my time. You're not likely to go for whatever it is they're pitching, but it must work at some point, otherwise it wouldn't do it, right?
Definitely. I mean, if they hit 1%, I mean, the initial investment is minimal. These calls cost less than 1 cent per call. So all they have to do is get one person on the line. It could either be a fraudulent call, which a good percentage of them are, or it could be someone who's actually trying to sell you something and using a robo device. Unfortunately, most of these robocalls are just blatantly illegal. I mean, even companies, what you think of as legitimate companies that are trying to sell you a product, may be in violation of the law, because you just can't be using these devices unless you have authorization to use them.
What's the language of the law?
Well, first of all, when we're talking about a robocall, it's a computerized auto dialer that's designed to deliver a pre-recorded message.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a robot calling you.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, if it goes to your wireless phone, your cell phone, mm-hmm. it's almost always illegal. There are very, very few exceptions relating to that. It could be an emergency type of situation, or if you have given your specific authorization prior to it to a company, they can do it. But almost always, if you're getting a robocall on your cell phone, it's going to be in violation of the law. It's illegal.
What recourse does you have? Because you can't talk back to them. It's a robot, right?
Well, there is recourse, but the problem is if you're dealing with someone who's a criminal or just engaged in fraud, as a practical matter, it's certainly for a citizen, it's going to be extremely difficult for them to do anything. And it's a challenge for the law enforcement authorities such as us. I mean, you have the Federal Trade Commission that recently took action against this character out of Miami who's responsible for millions and millions of robocalls.
Hmm.
And after a long process, they actually got a $130 million penalty to be assessed against him. But, you know, he was selling things like supposedly vacations to the Caribbean, to all these other places in the South. But he was just engaging in fraud. He was using the names without their permission of legitimate hotel chains. So you've got that. And then you've got people like, a lot of people have received phone calls here in Hawaii and across the country in Mandarin Chinese.
I just got one last week, yeah.
And these are just out-and-out scams. And what they're doing is trying to prey on the insecurities of, you know, immigrants, mm-hmm. good people here in Hawaii and across the mainland who are, you know, from China. And the calls purportedly are coming from the Chinese consulate, asking people to contact them right away because the authorities in China believe they've engaged in some kind of financial fraud. So it scares the heck out of people. They contact them and they try to scam them.
What do they want you to do? In the
Well, ultimately what they want you to do is give them money.
Sure.
And I read about someone in New York, a Chinese woman who was scammed out of $1.2 million.
Wow.
So it's...
Playing on insecurities is a powerful way to go, because another call that I've gotten a few times in the last couple of months is allegedly from the IRS. And everybody's got insecurities where that's concerned.
Right? That's true. Obviously, you probably recognize this as a scam immediately. But again, a lot of people may not recognize that as a scam. But if you're getting a call from the IRS on something like that, threatening to put you in jail if you don't call them back and things like that, it's obviously a scam.
Well, it might not be that obvious, you know, although the IRS has made it very clear that we don't ever phone people, still, you know, you might say, well, do I dare ignore this?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, a lot of people are frightened getting calls from an organization like the IRS, but we tell people, as you just said, first of all, the IRS doesn't contact people in that way.
Exactly.
So if you're getting a call from the IRS, it's going to be a scam.
Well, I've also gotten calls recently that have my, you know, 808 area code and even my, Windward Oahu prefix. So I see the number on my phone and I think, well, this is probably somebody I know. Turns out to be a robocall. How do they hone in on my area code and prefix like that?
Well, they are able to – it's called neighbor spoofing. Mm-hmm. So the technology stuff is such that it's relatively easy for them to mimic a number and impersonate a number. As a matter of fact, with IRS scams, some people were reporting that on their caller ID, it came up as the IRS calling, actually. So you can't rely on your caller ID to determine whether it's a scam or not. And this is a common thing. I was talking to someone the other day who was here in Hawaii, and she originally got her cell number while she was living in Wisconsin, and she's constantly getting these spoof calls from a Wisconsin area code. And as you experienced, people here in Hawaii are getting calls all the time with 808 numbers. I get them from Maui. I get them from Hilo. I get them from Oahu. It's just a chronic problem. And it's a terrible thing for someone who's, for instance, I've heard of situations, they're visiting someone in the hospital or expecting a telephone call from a loved one regarding an illness or mm-hmm. something, and all of a sudden they're getting blasted with these robocalls with a local area code. And of course they're going to pick it up because they have no idea who it actually is.
When you're talking about the man arrested in Florida who just one individual had initiated millions of calls, how do you go about doing that?
Well, you buy the computer software, and from what I understand, it's not particularly expensive, and you just start blasting out these phone calls.
Don't
to
you
these
have
numbers.
To get a bunch of numbered accounts?
You can the computer can call numbers sequentially, so some of the numbers won't actually be valid numbers, but some of them will be. So if you just go with say 808-555-1212,
yeah,
and then they'll go 808-555-1223 and so forth, and they'll just be doing it constantly, and they can dial hundreds of numbers per minute. So, and they do it simultaneously.
So they don't actually have that account. They're just pretending to have that number?
For the most part, they're not that sophisticated in the sense they are targeting someone who they know has called, that they've called before. They're just calling numbers sequentially. There are instances in which, for instance, if you've been victimized before, there are so-called hot lists, so they call them sucker lists in the business, where they'll try to prey on the person again.
It sounds as if, you know, the enforcement, and I've had this perception in other areas of uses of the internet, that enforcement is kind of playing catch up, that it's very difficult to keep up with the advances in technology, and as soon as one advance is made, you're able to make a million calls before somebody catches up to you. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. These cases are not easy to make. It's like peeling an onion. There are various levels that you have to go through to find out where the calls are emanating from. A lot of times they're emanating from China or Russia or Eastern Europe mm-hmm. or Africa. And then, of course, there are jurisdictional challenges. I believe the Federal Trade Commission and the FBI just announced the busting up a gang in India that was responsible for this robocalling and telemarketing fraud. It involves a lot of resources. You know, people obviously, because of this, people have to guard against these kind of abuses themselves. I would suggest that if you have caller ID, the easiest way of doing it, if you don't recognize the number, let them leave a message.
Yeah. Well, if you had your druthers, Steve, what would you like to see done to, you know, mitigate this problem?
I would like to see, for instance, the wireless carriers and the telecommunications companies to really do more than they've been doing right now. I think that there are efforts on their part to be the first line of defense against these robocalls, and I think they're trying to attack the problem. But as you mentioned, Chris, it is a challenge for law enforcement and for the communication companies to defend against these unscrupulous people.
So right now, pretty much all we can do is not pick up if we don't recognize who it is calling
you. I believe that's really good advice. You know, if you're unclear as to who it is, don't pick up. If you do get a call, you know, sometimes the call says they'll give you the spiel, and then they'll say, for more information, you know, press 1. If you want to be taken off of this list, press 2. Well, if you hit 1, you're going to be talking to someone who's going to put trying to convince you of something, to buy something you don't want to do. If you hit 2, they know it's a good line, and it really is not going to help you at all. They're not going to take you off the list, most probably.
Stephen Levins is the executive director of the State of Hawaii's Office of Consumer Protection, the state agency responsible for enforcing Hawaii's consumer protection laws. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, what expansion of broadband access to 5G will mean for Hawaii. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking of an outspoken and often forgotten princess of the House of Kamehameha. At a time when Hawaii was becoming rapidly modernized and exposed to outside influence, this woman stood proud as a defender of traditional Hawaiian tradition, faith, and values. She served as royal governor to the island of Hawaii, and in her capacity as a stateswoman, presided over what would eventually become the lands of the Bernice Pauahi Bishop Estate. As Hawaii became Christianized, she proudly clung to ancient tradition and practice. A lavish mansion, Hulihe'e Palace, was built in Kona to house her and her family, but she instead chose to occupy a modest stone-raised grass hut she had built on the estate grounds. She spoke English fluently, but refused to speak anything other than the Hawaiian language. And when Mauna Loa erupted in 1880, many credited her intercession with Madame Pele for stopping the flow of lava and ultimately saving the town of Hilo. For today's Backyard Quiz, we wanted to know her name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Tim Savage from the movie Under the Blood Red Sun. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Memory loss. 1 in 8 people over the age of 65 has Alzheimer's disease. Nearly half of those over the age of 85 have been diagnosed with this increasingly common disorder. What kind of toll does this take on those who are diagnosed and their loved ones? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll start our two-part series on memory loss and dementia. Today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
App-based services and businesses have fundamentally changed the economic landscape, but their evolution would not have been possible without a high-speed wireless network over which to transmit all that data. That network is known as 4G or LTE. The next generation of even faster wireless networks is known as 5G and is poised to further change an already dynamic digital landscape. But those networks can't be built without first developing the infrastructure to support 5G. Last week, Governor Ige signed a law that will establish a permitting process for companies seeking to build 5G infrastructure in Hawaii. It's part of an initiative to grow Hawaii's tech sector and make the Aloha State attractive to mainland tech companies. Bert Lum is the strategy officer for the Hawaii Broadband Initiative, and he spoke with our producer, Ryan Finity, to explain what it'll take to bring 5G to Hawaii.
Really, what happened was over the course of the last couple of years, there's been strong interest on the part of the wireless carriers as well as government on enabling the small cell transmitters, which would basically reside on things like light poles. So, you know, if you look at all the light poles and the fixtures that are being managed by whether it's state or city and county, even on the neighbor islands, these are places where these small cells could reside. And with things like 5G, it's going to require a lot more of these small cells.
Before we get too deep into it, Bert, what is a small cell antenna, and why is the state government concerned with them?
Well, so if you think of the evolution of cellular or wireless technology, you know, you have your 3G cells that basically require, you know, these towers, right? And you can probably see some of them when you drive around. You can see some of these sort of fake trees, right? Those are those cell towers. You had 3G, you had 4G, or also referred to as LTE. And what's happening with 5G is that it's higher bandwidth capacity, but you need more of these cells, or what they call small cells, in order to create the network that you with your cell phone would connect to. So what's happening is that instead of, you know, intermittent cell towers, you're requiring much more small cells to be installed.
So these are necessary for the next generation of wireless technology.
That's right. And what's happening is that with 5G, two of the real key specifications is that it's much faster. So we're talking about gigabit rates, and it's low latency. So we're talking about 1 to 2 milliseconds.
And so this bill that was just signed into law would create a framework for installing these small cells, these small cell 5G antennas on existing infrastructure rather than having to build towers or something like
well,
that.
Well, yeah, and what the bill really was kind of intended to do was try to set some sort of standard way that the wireless installation crews that are going out there and looking at putting these small cells up have a standard process by which they can apply to the government, whether it be city and county or your neighbor islands or even the state, so that they could put in a request to install these small cells on the light fixtures, right? So it's got to be an organized fashion, right? You can't have a free-for-all.
And so right now there are multiple cellular network providers. Are we potentially looking at a situation where Sprint and Verizon and AT&T are all going to be trying to install these small antennas on light posts around Hawaii?
That's exactly right. So what happens is that It's, you know, think of it like a, in a way, it's sort of a rush to get the best sites. And there are already efforts to sort of carve out, you know, where would be the optimal places to put these small cells. So it behooves the wireless carriers, whether it's the T-Mobiles, the Sprints, the Verizons, AT&Ts, to start looking at, okay, so, you know, where would we put these cells to optimize our coverage?
And is that something they've already been doing, or is this still kind of off in the distance?
There's already projects underway. So one of the, and I have to differentiate between the folks that are actually putting in the small cells versus the carriers that you would, you know, ultimately buy a service from. So I'll mention a couple of names. So one example is Boingo, and Boingo has put in some Wi-Fi access points over at the airport. And that was in the news this past week. And that's really interesting because, you know, Wi-Fi is also a wireless technology. And what's interesting about what Boingo is doing is that, you know, they have Wi-Fi coverage around the airport, and they are now prepared with their infrastructure in place to migrate to 5G. So that's an example of you know, one company that's prepared to see the technology evolution, because the Wi-Fi 5G specifications are still being worked out, right? So that's, it's not like you can go off and buy 5G equipment off the shelf and then start installing them. So it's still a migration process. Another one that you will hear about is a company called Mobility, and Mobility is also putting in antennas on specified sites in preparation for 5G. Their initial install is for augmenting their 4G network, and they're working with Sprint, you know, to augment Sprint's network. So they're the ones that actually put in the antennas, and then the companies like the Sprints and the Verizons, they ride on top of that, or they basically hire them to put the put the antennas together for them.
So, Bert, it seems like this is an opportunity for some newcomers into the industry, because it's a whole new set of infrastructure that's being created, meaning that Sprint and Verizon and the incumbents don't necessarily have a huge advantage in it. Do you expect to see startups getting into 5G or newcomers into the wireless industry?
Well, so what's interesting, and we should keep an eye out on what happens with this, is that, you know, first and foremost, 5G enables a whole new set of applications. And, you know, in addition to the high speeds that you can now get, you know, up to the gigabit rates, there will be applications that will take advantage of 5G, and, you know, things like smart city and connected cars, and you can have things like sort of fixed wireless applications where, instead of, you know, at home just getting your wired connection, you can now instead get a fixed wireless connection, and that would service your home. So you don't have to worry about your Wi-Fi connection. You can actually get a 5G connection. So with that in mind, what you need to start kind of keeping an eye out for is if companies are starting to look at installing these antennas, you can start to see new players potentially getting into the market. Now, what has recently happened, which I find interesting, and again, this is a bit speculative, but with sort of the net neutrality rules getting revoked, which now kind of enables some of the major carriers to potentially throttle certain kinds of content, in addition to the fact that you have Comcast and AT&T, you know, buying content providers like Time Warner and 20th Century Fox, you're going to start to see the content providers, the big content providers, and think of the Googles, which have YouTube or Netflix or Amazon, which Amazon Prime. You're going to start seeing them start to consider, well, how do they reach their end user? If, you know, and is there a way that they can get into the market without having to go through what we would consider those incumbents, right? So it's a little bit of a speculation on my part, but you know, if they're looking at trying to touch their customer at the end user, how would they best do that and still be free of delivering their content without necessarily being throttled? So those are some of the interesting things that are happening, you know, in the market right now, and I sort of suspect that the landscape will start to change.
It sounds like this has the potential to be a real disruptor in the way that 4G gave rise to the app economy.
I think you're right. I mean, there's definitely, you know, again, these new applications, the new capabilities, and of course, you know, we're talking about sort of the real-time delivery of services, given the speeds and the latencies. Yeah, there's a wide open field for applications, and then on top of that, you have now the content providers that are incented to reach the end user in a much more direct manner.
That was Bert Lum, strategy officer for the Hawaii Broadband Initiative at the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, speaking with Conversation producer Ryan Finity. Bert is also the co-host of Hawaii Public Radio's Tech Focus show, Bite Marks Cafe. Tomorrow on The Conversation, we'll have the second part of Ryan's interview with Bert. He'll explain how high-speed connectivity physically makes it to the most remote population center on Earth and why Hawaii is at risk of being bypassed by future broadband internet infrastructure. Honolulu's ever-growing street population poses a challenge to the police and EMTs who respond to emergency calls when they find themselves confronted with situations better left to mental health professionals. According to the head of Honolulu Emergency Psychological Services and Jail Diversion Program, too many severely mentally ill people are not getting the help they need. Brittany Light has the story in today's Reality Check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Brittany.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You know, this is something that we've known intuitively for a long time, that police have an enormous burden in dealing with mentally ill calls, but there's a new report that backs that up, yeah?
Yeah, so this new report is really interesting. It really chronicles the 11-year history of a program that's a collaboration between the police department, healthcare agencies, and local hospitals. And one of the goals of the program is to reduce the number of people who are mentally ill or emotionally disturbed, reduce the amount of them who are being arrested when there isn't a crime being committed. So if a police officer is responding to an incident that involves someone who is mentally ill or emotionally disturbed, there's another option. The officer can act as a bridge to healthcare services. Of course, the officer can offer voluntary services, but one of the symptoms of severe mental illness is that you don't know that you are mentally ill. So often what happens is these people are transported to a local hospital where they're able to have a mental health evaluation or treatment for up to 48 hours.
A lot of people with severe mental illness, the last person they want to see is a uniformed authority figure, right?
That is true. It is true, especially for someone who doesn't have the recognition to know that they are displaying these symptoms of mental illness. But what this report says that is important is that sending some of these people who were the most severely mentally ill to a hospital for up to 48 hours, it's just not enough. It's not enough services. It's not enough treatment. When they're released, you know, they still are in a state of crisis, or at least vulnerable to going back to a state of crisis. For the vast majority of people, more than 80% of people who encounter a police officer who's working with a police psychologist, they are helped and they don't have a repeat encounter with police. But there is this smaller but still significant population of people with mental illness who are sort of going through the revolving door of, you know, having police encounters and being transported to the hospital and then, you know, all over again maybe a few weeks later.
It's an ongoing challenge, Brittany. Thanks very much for your story.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
That was reporter Brittany Light with today's reality check from Civil Beat. To read the full story, you can visit civilbeat.org. We're always interested in what you have to say about the issues we cover on this program. And last week, Mark called from Hawaii Island in response to another listener's claim that the temporary microstructures being built for displaced Puna residents were, quote, oven boxes.
They're actually insulated in the ceiling and in the walls. I know because I was there helping do that. We seem kind of short-staffed there, too. So I'm wondering if that caller was actually there to help. Everybody's doing their best to try to make this work. Those houses are insulated from the ceiling to the walls, and they have two windows and the door for ventilation.
After last week's segment discussing state support of homeowners insurance in lava-prone areas, James Dixon wrote this. Speak with any real estate professional, and you will know that Hawaii Property Insurance Association policies are significantly more expensive than the regular market and are to be avoided if possible because of the expense. This is consistent with the purpose of the HPIA as the market of last resort for the entire state of Hawaii, not just those in the lava zones. It serves to ensure that the real estate market in Hawaii is not upended by the volatility of insurance markets. For example, when my wife and I purchased our home in Oahu in 2003, the regular homeowners insurance market was not issuing policies on newly purchased older homes that had outdated electrical and water systems. Without homeowners insurance, we would not have qualified for the mortgage and would have had to pass on the home. The HPIA premiums were significantly higher than those offered by Allstate or other insurers, but those carriers weren't going to sell a policy to us anyway. We thank you for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 792-8217. Some know it as the Boo Boo Zoo. The East Maui Refuge Center is a no-kill shelter for animals of all kinds. The facility has existed for 40 years and operates thanks to its volunteer staff that cares for some 500 creatures, feathered and hoofed. Catherine Cruz paid a visit there recently and talked to founder Sylvan Schwab. It's a startling sight for folks who haven't seen the barn red compound, and there's definitely no getting away from the menagerie of sounds. From peacocks to chickens and pueo to deer, horses, and goats, such is life at the Last Chance Shelter.
The Boo Boo Zoo takes in, we take in orphaned, injured, animals in distress. Any animal that there is no place else to send it to. So there are a lot of other dog and cat organizations, but we do have, I have 109 cats here right now, but the ones we end up with are either ones that are going to be long-term expensive cases that most adoption agencies just don't have the facility to take care of. Lifelong cares. The area we're in right now, the cats are feline AIDS and feline leukemia positive, and we're the only facility in Hawaii that takes in cats that are feline AIDS and feline leukemia positive. So cats that need long-term care or immediate severe medical care. And the same with dogs, ones that are in critical care, if they're crippled or have some other kind of severe problem. But mainly it's the animals that there is no other type of facility to take it to. We got 58 goats right now, 35 deer, and hundreds and hundreds of various types of birds, fowl, anything that normal places just don't take in.
And I did see a peacock on the car out front.
Yeah, we have a lot of those. Actually, we sort of inherited those. There was a person across the road that used to raise them, and when she moved out, she left behind all the ones she hadn't sold, and so we inherited a lot of peacocks, and I've actually adopted a lot of peacocks out because for some reason my neighbors don't enjoy the screaming of a peacock at 2 o'clock in the morning. I know,
wonder
hard
why.
To understand. I don't get it either, but, you know, I guess everybody has their thing. But, and, yeah, as you might have heard, a rooster or two here and there. Yeah, I mean, the rooster problem, the chicken problem in general is something that's all over the island. And actually, there was a citizens committee that approached the mayor about the feral chickens and roosters and trying to cure it. And he allocated $25,000, brought in a professionals from the mainland to solve the problem of feral roosters and chickens. And after $25,000, they concluded that there's nothing you can do about it, which is basically the case, because once a rooster impregnates a hen, she puts out fertile eggs for 2 years. So, you know, it only takes one rooster to populate the whole area, and chickens go out in the woods and have their babies, and so it's just going to keep happening. So, yeah, we've got a lot of chickens that we don't intentionally propagate. We neuter everything that comes in, spay the things that get spayed. Livestock doesn't normally get spayed. We neuter the males and that, but dogs and cats all get neutered and spayed. Yeah, basically, still, we're up to about 500 animals. It's around $30,000 a month is what it takes to run the place, and that's without any salaries. Everybody's a volunteer. You know, 500 animals, there's a lot to take care of there.
And you have plans to add a few structures on property?
Well, we are, since we have, I mean, I just calculated last year we spent just under $70,000 just in veterinary costs. So we built a house that a live-in veterinarian can live in, and downstairs we're going to build a clinic, not just for our own animals, but we're planning on having a community clinic that will be strictly by donation as far as people having an emergency need with an animal, because I get calls weekly from people having to bring their animals in for emergency care, either sick or hit by cars, and it happens all the time. And with the cost of veterinary care right now, most places require at least $2,000 down to do emergency services, and most people don't have a couple of grand handy that they can just slap down to save their animal's life, and a lot of them are crying on the phone because they're going to have their animal euthanized because they don't have the money to have it cared for. And years ago, we had a good donation when I was trying to help out people then, but funds are at the point now where we're just barely paying the bills. So we decided that we need to build a structure that we can have a facility here, not just for our own costs, but to help the whole community out with emergency animal care.
And the last time I paid a visit here, you had you were a wildlife rehabilitation center as well. You had some poeo and some other endangered birds.
Well, we still do wildlife, but now instead of just rehabilitation, which requires euthanization if they can't go back in the wild, now that's why we have 35 deer here right now, because wildlife, when it comes in here now, it has to stay here because now we're licensed by the Department of Agriculture, who licenses zoos. And so now our permit requires that everything that we take in stays here. So there's a lot more paperwork involved, but at least we don't have to worry about being forced to euthanize healthy animals just because they can't make it back in the wild.
And you had a number of animals who were blind. A horse,
yeah.
A couple of deer, a dog.
Blind pig. We have several. I have a whole room of blind cats. We have three blind deer, a few blind goats. Blindness, you know, some of it happens from trauma, and some of it happens from cataracts. Juvenile cataracts are very common, especially with wildlife, because if a female has any kind of bacterial infection in the uterus when she's pregnant, it's not unusual for an animal to be born blind with juvenile cataracts. And so, it's not like it's debilitating to an animal, because once a blind animal knows its space, it gets along just fine. And like I said, I have a blind room for the cats, and there's a couple in there that are partially blind, but they get around fine. You know, when you have blind animals, they have to know their area. That's all. You just have to provide that.
Right. So, but whatever the boo boo.
Whatever the boo boo is, we find a way. Everything that comes in through a veterinarian. So before we even start, you know, immediate emergency care is taken care of. And then from then on, we have to do ongoing care. And I have a standing appointment every week with a vet to bring in whatever we need to bring in. And we have a couple of veterinarians who are part of the Department of Agriculture program who come in regularly and check things out here and make sure that everything's looking good here. And so, you got to stay on top of it. And it's a lot of work and a lot of money, but it's a lot of enjoyment, a lot of feeling like you have done something worthwhile, and that's what life is all about.
And the volunteers here, like you said, you have lots of loyal ones. But at some point, do you ever think, oh gosh, this is maybe more than I can handle?
That's why we have so many volunteers. Yeah, it's definitely more than I can handle. Yeah, one person couldn't do this at this point. It's just, like I said, we have 15 regulars who are here every week. And, you know, there's a lot of people who have a big heart for animals. And though most of them only come one day a week, they get their animal fix here because a lot of them live someplace that they can't have animals. And a lot of them are just lovers of animals that know what we're doing. It just feels good to take care of them.
And you did have kind of a benefactor at one point who made a donation that kind of got all embroiled in a kind of a lengthy lawsuit.
Well, anytime somebody leaves a lot of money to a lot of people, you know, there's going to be people who are saying, it's all mine, no, it's all mine. And yeah, there was one individual who, when that gentleman was on his last years and he became a little senile, he signed papers there was like 20 different nonprofit organizations that were benefactors. And, excuse me, this one individual had the whole thing signed away to him. And that's what the whole brouhaha was about. And it took a lot of lawyers and court cases and things to finally settle it out and prove that he was not of sound mind when he signed that document. And so in the end, everybody, you know, got a good support that he had intended to leave. And even that individual who did that ended up getting taken care of as well. So nobody was hurt by the thing. But, yeah, he inherited literally millions and millions of dollars and lived a ripe old age. And, when we live a ripe old age, some of us lose a little bit of our memory. And, you know, not me, of course. Not. Just because I'm over 70 doesn't mean I don't remember everything, because I don't remember anything, actually.
But does this place keep you young?
It keeps me going, yeah. Yeah, if you need exercise, you got no choice. Yeah, you got to do it, yeah. And, yeah, no, it keeps me going. I don't know if I keep me young, but it keeps me happy. Yeah, we love doing it. Can't imagine doing anything else.
That was Catherine Cruz talking with Sylvan Schwab of Maui's Boo Boo Zoo. The No-Kill Refuge Center hopes to raise money to build a new barn and open its community clinic as part of its blueprint for its future. For links, you can go to our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Annie Kamiya from the band Mango Season, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and also what we can try and spot in our dark island skies. As usual, we are so grateful to have the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we welcome him back now. Hey, Christopher, what do you have this week for us?
Hey, Dave, good to be back. So this week, stargazers, look out for Jupiter visible in the south just after sunset. It will be joined by Saturn in the east at around 7 p.m. The moon this week will be full, meaning spotting faint objects is going to be very challenging indeed.
I understand you've got some news from South America where some astronomers are testing some of Einstein's theories?
Yes, astronomers at the VLT, or Very Large Telescope, in Chile have been observing distant galaxies in an attempt to prove that Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity is truly universal, meaning that it applies throughout the known universe. By observing the light from distant galaxies, they have proven that, yes, indeed it is.
Quick reminder on the general theory of relativity.
Well, Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity describes how massive objects, such as stars and planets, can warp space and time. This warping of space-time is what we humans perceive as gravity. A massive object like the Sun creates a greater warping of space than a small planet like the Earth. And a very massive object, like a black hole, warps space so much that practically nothing can escape its gravitational pull, not even light.
And light can, as weird as it sounds, be bent by this warping of space and time, huh?
Indeed it can. We tend to think of light traveling in straight lines from one point to another in space, but in actual fact, its path can be changed depending on if it gets close to something very massive like a black hole.
And that's gravitational microlensing, right? We can use that.
Yes, and this is what the astronomers at the VLT were doing. They were making the most precise measurements yet of the curvature of space-time by looking at gravitational microlensing in distant galaxies.
And what do you think Albert Einstein would think of all this, Christopher?
I think he'd be thoroughly impressed. Because over 100 years, his theory is still describing perfectly the types of things we see everywhere in the cosmos.
Is that when he came up with that theory?
It was back in 1915.
Wow. Dude was a heavy cat, huh?
Indeed he was.
It is Christopher Phillips celebrating one of the many things we have to celebrate from Albert Einstein this week here on Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary and 15 years of support for the Hawaii Architectural Foundation. Committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design, FerraroChoi.com.
Though the U.S. minister to Hawaii at the time referred to her as a woman of no intelligence or ability, Ruth Ke'ili Kolani was anything but. In the face of a changing Hawaii, Ke'ili Kolani stood proud and tall, not just figuratively, but literally. At 6'1" and weighing at one point over 400 pounds, Ke'ili Kolani was an imposing figure who commanded respect and authority in both her government dealings and her strict adherence to Hawaiian tradition. While she was an effective stateswoman in her post as royal governor of Hawaii Island, her complicated parentage, claimed by two different men, excluded her from serious contention for the Hawaiian throne, though her legacy as a defender of tradition remains. With a voice described as a distant rumble of thunder, the memory of Ruth Ke'ili Kolani perseveres as a testament to tradition in the face of a changing world. And Carly Oliva was from Waipahu, was the first one to get that quiz. It was a popular quiz that had our phone lines ringing across the board. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I am Kanwa from Jamarek. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple Store or Google Play.
There are a lot of activities going on throughout our state, and Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, we're looking at two poets who are going to take the stage of the Doris Duke Theater tomorrow.
That's right. Actually, it's happening tomorrow. Naomi Nye of Texas and Kathy Song of Hawaii are longtime friends. You can join them for an evening of poetry as part of the Merwin Conservancy's Green Room Salon series. And the theme is the poetry's role as an antidote to the chaos in the world around us. This event is tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Doris Duke Theater.
That's Merwin Conservancy Green Room events that brought some really interesting people to Hawaii.
Yes, they happen on Maui mostly, right?
And tomorrow in Hilo, you can find out 10 ways to love your brain.
The Alzheimer's Association is holding this interactive workshop tomorrow. These fun suggestions are based on the latest research that indicates people can reduce their risk of memory loss by adopting certain healthy lifestyle habits. You'll find out what they are. Combine all of these habits to get the maximum benefit for your brain and your body. And this is happening tomorrow at 5 p.m. in the Hilo Public Library.
Sounds really worthwhile. And a book club will discuss the story of justice and redemption in Kona tomorrow.
The nonfiction book club talks about Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson. He's been called one of the most brilliant and influential lawyers of our time, and you will find out tomorrow. This book club meets at 6 p.m. tomorrow night in the Kona Stories bookstore.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. But tomorrow we'll get an update from Hawaii Island about the temporary housing situation for displaced families. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkrug. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.